Good afternoon. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette, dated for this state, Tuesday, March 3rd, 2020. Let's begin with the reading of the headlines. The first headline for today is for University of Illinois, Coach's New Deal. Never leave? That's Underwood's plan. This article is written by Scott Ritchie and is based out of Champaign. Brad Underwood didn't hesitate to mention Illinois' status as one of the nation's most storied programs when he took the Illini coaching job in March 2017. It quickly became one of his favorite talking points. The history of Illinois basketball, he said on more than one occasion, was elite. It's part of the reason why Underwood left Oklahoma State after just one season to take the reins at Illinois. It's also why he's now locked in at Illinois through the 2025-26 season after getting a three-year contract extension Monday afternoon. We came here for a reason, and that's to never leave, Underwood said Monday night during his radio show at Pop Dell's. To have that opportunity is pretty special. What's the old saying? You never mess with happy. We've got tremendous administrative support. Athletic Director Josh Whitman is here tonight. You don't win without great administrators, great support. Susan and I and the kids are ecstatic here. This is home. Sunday's 67-66 win against Indiana was the Illini's 20th of the season, the first time they've reached that mark in the regular season since 2012-2013. Illinois also heads into its final two games of the regular season this week, ranked at number 23 in the AP Top 25, and still in contention for a Big Ten title. The team's first NCAA tournament appearance since 2013 is also essentially a lock. That turnaround from a 12-21 record in 2019-2020, a program record for losses, played a part in Underwood's contract extension through the 2025-26 season, pending approval by the U of I Board of Trustees at its March 12th meeting. Underwood originally signed a six-year contract in 2017, and his salary this year is $2.958 million. His pending new deal will move his base salary to $3.4 million, and he will receive annual increases that will grow his salary to $4 million by the final year of the new contract. Underwood is also in line to earn a new $750,000 retention bonus if he concludes the contract's new terms as the Illinois coach. If Underwood were to accept a coaching position elsewhere, he would owe the university an $8 million buyout. That number will decrease each year of the agreement. Any NCAA tournament appearance between 2022 and 2025 allows for subsequent extensions potentially reaching the 2029-30 season. Underwood isn't the only coach receiving an extension. Illinois is increasing the salary pool for assistant coaches Orlando Antigua, Chin Coleman, and Stephen Gentry by 25%, and those three on-court assistants will have contracts through the 2021-22 season. Antigua has a $350,000 salary this season, and Coleman has a $225,000 salary this season. Details of Gentry's salary this season were not available. A 25% increase in the salary pool for that trio would likely put Illinois at approximately $1 million to spend on its assistant coaching pool. Strength and conditioning coach Adam Fletcher also agreed to an extension through the 2021-22 season. Head coaches get too much credit, too much blame, Underwood said Monday night. I say that, and yet every head coach is only as good as his staff. I've got a great, great staff. They're beating up the recruiting trails. They're preparing scouting reports. All of these guys in their own time are going to be head coaches, and they're going to be successful head coaches. We've got a great group. We all come from different backgrounds and all over the country, and yet we've meshed into something that's really, really special. Great human beings, and I'm very, very proud to have this group. The next headline reads, Election 2020. It's Judgment Day. Happy Super Tuesday, all. With Democrats in 14 states and one territory set to choose the candidate they want to see face President Donald Trump in November, we asked U of I political science professor Brian Gaines to break down the best and worst case scenarios for what's left of a field that lost Pete Buttigieg on Sunday and Amy Klobuchar on Monday. So the four candidates or potential candidates are Joe Biden, Mike Bloomberg, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. First up, Joe Biden. Best case, trampolining off of a first-place finish in South Carolina, the former VP beats the polls in nearly all states and ends the week nipping at Bernie Sanders' heels in the delegate count. Worst case, not even in North Carolina can Biden match his impressive South Carolina finish. Instead, almost everywhere he winds up in third or fourth place, and he misses the 15% viability threshold throughout the delegate goldmine of California. He calmly ends his 2020 run before Illinois votes. Next up, Mike Bloomberg. Best case scenario? Finally on a ballot, he proves that TV is king by outpacing his poll averages. All of those ads won over enough voters to give him over 300 delegates. With Klobuchar following Buttigieg's offstage, Bloomberg has more elbow room in the middle. Worst case? After missing the 15% mark in most states, he quits and replaces Michael Huffington and Meg Whitman in political science textbooks as the best proof that big money doesn't always prevail in elections. Next up, Bernie Sanders. Best case? Smashing the 25% ceiling attributed to socialists, he wins one-third or more of the vote in most of the contests, even beating Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts. When the counting is done, a 400-delegate lead over his nearest rival makes him look all but unbeatable. Warren withdraws, endorsing Sanders as the people's choice. Worst case, across the board, his vote totals lag behind his pre-election poll shares. More and more Democrats, publicly express doubts about his ability to beat Trump. And finally, Elizabeth Warren. Best case scenario, she finishes first in Massachusetts with a third of the vote and beats the 15% threshold in most states, seemingly drawing in a majority of the poll respondents who had been undecided. Multiple automatic delegates promptly announce their support for her as the candidate most likely to beat Trump. Worst case, she trails Sanders in Massachusetts and misses the 15% threshold in most states. Despite having repeatedly promised to be in the race for the long haul, she withdraws before week's end. Closer to home. In part two of our two-week primary countdown series, the two Democrats hoping to be Champaign County's next circuit clerk make their case for why they're the best candidate for the job. That's today in D1, and I'll read that. And plus, find out what two Republican contenders for John Shimkus' seat in the 15th Congressional District had to say to voters during a Monday appearance at the Champaign Public Library. And I'll read that in just a moment. Next up, though, the next headline reads, Coronavirus. UI students studying abroad, adjusting on the fly. This article is written by Ben Sigderman and is based out of Champaign. And next to this article is a small picture that's titled Panayota Laros in Italy. So it's a picture of a young woman provided by Panayota who's standing near a bridge and she's smiling at the camera. University of Illinois junior Panayota Laros was about 3 weeks into her study abroad program in Milan, Italy, when the school she was studying at suspended classes due to the spreading coronavirus. Laros, that's L-A-R-O-S, a Champaign native, studying accounting, said she initially wasn't sure what to do. Last Monday, when there were 229 cases in Italy, the U of I's Office of International Safety and Security said it was monitoring developments, adding that the U of I does not plan to suspend programs and or ask students to depart Italy. 2 days later, when the number of cases reached 400 and the U.S. government recommended certain travelers postpone travel to Italy, the U of I again said it does not anticipate canceling programs or asking students to depart. But Laros was nervous and decided to leave Wednesday. "I wanted to get away," she said. "I didn't want to get stuck in Italy." By Friday, when the Italian case count hit 800, the U of I was advising students to leave. By Saturday, it required all 137 students, that's 137 students, studying abroad in Italy to get out as soon as possible. There are now more than 1,500 confirmed cases of the new coronavirus in Italy. Laro said she's still talking with the U of I about what's next. Everything is still brand new, she said. I don't know how everything is going to work out. She had been told by Bocconi University, that's B-O-C-C-O-N-I, Bocconi University, where she'd been taking business classes, that exchange students can take the classes online. So I'll be studying at an Italian university, but in Champaign, Illinois, Laro said. They're still figuring out how to do exams, but for now I'll be taking online classes. She also has to stay at home for the next couple of weeks as a precaution. It can take up to 14 days for symptoms to appear, but Laro said Monday she felt fine and didn't think she has COVID-19, COVID-19. I left before it got really bad, and where I was living, the closest outbreak to me was 20 miles south of me, she said. The 3.5 weeks she spent in Italy made for an unbelievable experience, she said. I was meeting kids from all over the world. I traveled to Venice and had weekend trips planned, she said. Unfortunately, everything had to come to an end. It came to an end so quickly that Laros is still waiting on her luggage. I had the full intention of returning, so I didn't bring home all my stuff, she said. I did pack everything up, so right now I have a suitcase sitting in my room, and I'm trying to figure out how to get it back to me. She was roommates with a student studying abroad from South Korea who was worried about whether she'd be able to return to her home country, which has 4,000 confirmed cases. On Sunday, the U of I said it wouldn't require the 15 students taking classes abroad in South Korea to leave, but may do so in the future. By Monday, Chancellor Robert Jones and Provost Andreas Kangelaris said in a mass email that they were strongly encouraging students, faculty, members, and staff in any part of South Korea to depart voluntarily. They also offered all 852 students enrolled abroad in any country the opportunity to voluntarily end their program immediately. We are working diligently to arrange alternative methods to deliver instruction to any students who want to continue making academic progress this semester, the U of I administrators wrote. We recognize that there can be financial and academic implications for students, and we are committed to working with them to the best of our ability to mitigate any negative impacts. The U of I had already decided in January to suspend its spring semester academic programs in China, where the COVID-19 disease has infected more than 80,000 people. Also Monday, the U of I system announced a new COVID-19 planning and response team to coordinate efforts on the Urbana, Chicago, and Springfield campuses. The team will work with the standing response committees at the three universities to provide a common operating structure, plans, and action items, help disseminate information to all relevant stakeholders, and identify opportunities to support existing university-based personnel to help develop system-wide practices, U of I officials announced. Robert Barish, Vice Chancellor for Health Affairs at UIC, will lead the team, which will include members from each of the three universities, and report to U of I President Tim Colleen, Executive VP Barb Wilson, and the three chancellors and provosts. The next headline reads, Election 2020, 15th District, Republican hopefuls share similar message. This article is by Jim Dye and is based out of Champaign. Two more Republican U.S. House candidates from Illinois' 15th District spoke Monday to a local GOP group, mostly agreeing on the issues, but bringing sharply different backgrounds to their campaigns. Farmer businessman Kerry Wolf, K-E-R-R-Y, Wolf, W-O-L-F-F, of Altamont, who is part of a solar heating installing business, told active senior Republicans that he wants to bring jobs to the 33-county district now represented by retiring Republican U.S. Representative John Shimkus. There are many depressed areas in our district, he said. Camargo's Chuck Ellington, who is both a physician and a lawyer, said he learned the value of hard work from his father and is a walking, talking, living version of the American dream. That's what I want for each of you, he said. The appearances by Ellington and Wolf wrapped up the four GOP candidates' appearances before the senior Republicans. Last month, the group, which meets at the Champaign Public Library, hosted the two other GOP candidates, Mary Miller of Oakland and Vermilion County Treasurer Darren Duncan. In Trump, they trust. All four candidates presented themselves as conservative backers of President Donald Trump. Given the strong Republican nature of the sprawling district, the winner of the March GOP primary is likely to win the November general election. One of the geographically largest House districts in the nation, the 15th covers eastern and southeastern Illinois. The winner, however, will face an immediate political problem. Illinois is likely to lose one, possibly two, U.S. House seats as part of the 2020 census and the subsequent state and federal legislative restricting. Democratic map drawers can be expected to put the winner of the 15th district seat in the same district with another Republican House member, leaving them to fight it out to remain in Congress. That topic did not come up Monday, as the candidates focused on what's directly ahead, the primary election. Wolf, who is married to a pharmacist and is the father of two children, emphasized the usual GOP talking points about a federal government that is too big and too powerful. He said he favors lower taxes and less regulation. But Wolf also raised concerns about federal government spending, saying that current budget deficits are unsustainable and must be reduced. Ellington said that as a physician, he has found President Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act to be a bureaucratic nightmare that must be corrected. He called for more emphasis on primary medical care for all Americans, asserting that making it a priority would head off severe medical complication and be a money saver in the long run. If elected, he said he would seek legislation to train more primary care doctors. Agreement on immigration. Both candidates expressed support for Trump's policies to block illegal immigrants from crossing the Mexican border. Ellington said illegal crossings at the border encourage human trafficking that spreads human misery. He also said it's important for the U.S. to help boost the economies of South American countries so that people there do not seek to come to the U.S. illegally to gain employment. Wolf emphasized his support for legal immigration while decrying the Democrats' embrace of open borders, quote-unquote. He also criticized Democratic proposals for a Green New Deal as so prohibitively expensive that they'd wreck the economy. He also emphasized Illinois' bountiful supply of coal, asserting that technology improvements can scrub the coal of pollution and be useful as a source of energy. The back and forth among the audience and the candidates was different from last month's exchanges. In February, Miller and Duncan were asked about the Democrats' efforts to impeach Trump and remove him from office. In the aftermath of the Senate trial acquitting Trump of abuse of power allegations, the issue did not come up during Monday's exchanges. And now let's take a moment to look at our weather forecast for the next week. This is provided to us by Greg Solier and his column on the weather front. Several weak, fast-moving disturbances will result in scattered showers in many areas of the country. The week's most consequential storm will be the weather system currently exiting Southern California. That storm will move eastward, reaching the western Gulf Coast region by midweek. Subsequently, the storm system will produce soaking rainfall in parts of the southeast. 5-day precipitation totals could reach 1 to 2 inches in Texas, excluding the northern panhandle and the southern part of the state, and 2 to 4 inches or more in the southeast, excluding Florida's peninsula. Generally, light precipitation will occur in other areas of the country, except in parts of the northeast and northwest. Today, 53 degrees, becoming windy, mostly sunny, southwest winds 6 to 12 miles per hour, shifting westerly and increasing to 20 to 30 miles per hour. It'll be gusty. Overnight, windy early, a few clouds, west to northwest wind diminishing. Wednesday, the high is 51, the low is 33, mostly sunny and mild, northwest wind 8 to 16 miles per hour, gusty. Overnight, increasing clouds. North-northeast wind becoming east to southeast. Thursday, the high is 56, the low is 33. Partly sunny, windy, and mild. southerly wind increasing to 15 to 25 miles per hour, and gusty. Friday, the high is 44, the low is 35. Partly cloudy, cooler. Saturday, the high is 49, the low is 29, and it will be sunny. And now, top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Jim Rosso. Much of the credit for our latest national honor goes to the high school students who visit our newsroom in full uniform 3 times a year. Our Faces of the Fall project was singled out by editor and publisher in the magazine's annual 10 News Publishers That Do It Right list published in its March issue. The News Gazette, which received honorable mention, was among a group of 20 news outlets, including Chicago's Tribune and Sun-Times, recognized for bright and creative ideas taking place around our industry. We produce 3 faces each school year, inviting high schoolers in for photographs, radio spots, and social media opportunities. We'll do it again March 15th. It's the 5th time since 2015 that the News Gazette has been tabbed by editor and publisher in its Do It Right edition. Previously, the News Gazette was honored for its engagement strategy in the top 10, video implementation, honorable mention, high school confidential, honorable mention, and last year a newsroom-wide podcast push, which placed them in the top 10. Visit our website for a link to editor and publisher's story on this year's winners. History. Area history. In 1920, a fire yesterday destroyed the lumber yard of Hazen and Franks in Sydney, entailing a loss of $10,000 above insurance coverage and threatening the entire village for much of the afternoon. The lumber yard is located just west of the railroad depot. In 1970, Governor Richard Ogilvie, on Tuesday, mobilized the Illinois National Guard because of violence on the University of Illinois campus. A total of 750 men were called to active duty by the governor after 30 people were arrested Monday on the campus. A speech scheduled by Chicago 7 defense attorney William Kunstler to be held Tuesday night at the auditorium was canceled. Damage to campus facilities was estimated at between $15,000 and $20,000. In 2005, combine a top-ranked basketball team, a fundraising item turned fashion statement, and orange rubber, and what do you get? $100,000 for the University of Illinois Library. That's how much the U of I's Division of Intercollegiate Athletics expects to donate this year to the library's fund drive. The money comes from its sale of orange loyalty wristbands. And in international history, today's highlight, on March 3, 1931, the Star-Spangled Banner became the national anthem of the U.S. as President Herbert Hoover signed a congressional resolution. Also on this date, in 1791, Congress passed a measure taxing distilled spirits, the first Internal Revenue Act in U.S. history. In 1845, Florida became the 27th state. In 1863, President Abraham Lincoln signed a measure creating the National Academy of Sciences. In 1934, bank robber John Dillinger escaped from the Lake County Jail in Crown Point, Indiana, along with another prisoner, Herbert Youngblood. In 1991, motorist Rodney King was severely beaten by Los Angeles police officers in a scene captured on amateur video. In 1996, Israel declared total war against the militant group Hamas after a bus bomb in Jerusalem killed 19 people, including the bomber, the third such suicide attack in 8 days. And now from our editorials, ugly picture of camera bill. The dirty little secrets surrounding red light cameras are secrets no more. This is collectively written by the editorial section or editorial board of the News Gazette, which is Paul Barrett, publisher, Jeff D'Alessio, editor, Jim Dye, opinions editor, and Tom Kachik, columnist. With the specter of rampant public corruption related to red light cameras hanging over the General Assembly, many legislators are rushing to separate themselves from the issue. That's one reason why members of the Illinois House voted overwhelmingly this week to ban the cameras in non-home rule communities. State Representative David McSweeney, the chief House sponsor of the bill, noted that the legislation is the same bill I passed in 2015 that later died a suspicious death. This is the bill that is so dangerous to the red light camera companies that they acted to bribe a state senator, he said. McSweeney is referring to former Chicago State Senator Martin Sandoval, then chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee, and now a chief stool pigeon for federal investigators looking into corruption, including that related to red light cameras, underneath the State House dome. The bill next goes to the Senate, and it will be interesting to see how it's treated there. Members of the Senate have good reason to avoid being seen as supporters of this pickpocket approach to municipal government. Perhaps Senate leaders will block the legislation from ever getting a vote. Perhaps they will yield to public concern over this high-profile issue. Whatever they decide will be revealing. After passing the bill in the House, McSweeney immediately announced that he wants to move on similar legislation, House Bill 323, that would ban all red light cameras in Illinois, including those in home rural communities. The legislation is trapped in the House Rules Committee, and it won't get out unless Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan decided to let it out. That, of course, is where the small army of lobbyists representing red light camera interests, the companies that sell them and the municipalities that use them to unjustly enrich themselves, come into play. The forces of the corrupt status quo have plenty of money and influence to spread around and won't hesitate to do so. Red light cameras, to put it succinctly, are a disgrace to the state. They represent not only terrible public policy, but a source of public corruption. Backers say they promote public safety by fining motorists who do not come to a full and complete stop at designated intersection, $100 each. There's no defense to a ticket. Motorists who are targeted have no choice but to pay up. But a study commissioned by the Chicago Tribune showed the cameras pose more of a threat to public safety from rear-end collision than a safety enhancement. Besides, why is not coming to a full complete halt at a stop sign when no threat is present worth $100? The answer is that the municipalities that host these demonic machines want the money. The red light cameras generate lots of it, hence the corruption that goes with it. Though the arguments of red light defenders are weak, their numbers are strong. While only four legislators summoned the courage to vote against McSweeney's bill, nearly 30 lacked the courage to vote at all. They included Republican State Representative Tom Bennett of Gibson City. What an embarrassment. It's impossible to say whether either of McSweeney's bills will become law. But defenders of the red light cameras revealed their true selves when they defended them as necessary generators of revenue. The defenders should be thanked for confirming the obvious. The cameras are all about the money. They have to go. Today on WDWS 1400 AM, tune in for The Morning Show with State Treasurer Mike Frerichs as he stops by our studios at 7:40 AM. Penny, for your thoughts, it's open line with host Brian Barnhart at 9 a.m. before Paul Ruidi visits at 10 a.m. to talk about his financial show's 30-year radio run. To chime in, you can always call 217-356-9397 or text 217-351-5357. Also on newsgazette.com, Inside Illini Basketball with Scott Ritchie. On Ayo Dosunmu's impact on recruiting. Every basketball player in Chicago is like, you can go to Illinois, be successful, wind up in the NBA. The fact that they're able to follow up Ayo Dosunmu with incoming recruit Adam Miller makes a difference. For our entire menu, visit our website and click on podcasts. I'm Susan Muirhead. Thank you very much for listening. This has been part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, March 3rd, 2020. I'll be back shortly with part two. Please stay with me.